Welcome to the DFA Podcast. On today's episode, we talk about the Pirates management and front office extensions. We talk about some top prospects, and we talk about Pagans. It's all here on the DFA Podcast.
And welcome to episode 29 of the DFA Podcast. I'm your host, Brian Grosnick. Joining me, as always, my co-host, RJ Anderson of CBS Sports. RJ, it's a beautiful Monday morning, right?
Yeah, thank goodness. Seems like the hurricane down south could have been much worse. And now we get to go back to life's frivolities for the most part, including talking about baseball transactions.
Yeah, the absolute least important thing to talk about in the event of a hurricane or any sort of natural disaster. I know our listeners may not know this, but RJ and I both have a lot of family in Florida. I was born in the Tampa area. RJ's from Florida as well and's got a lot of family down there, so we're always hoping that for the best in these sort of instances, especially down in Florida. So it's good to hear that.
And our producer Sean Brody is basically from Florida because he always loses his debit card, so
Florida,
it's very much a Florida production here.
Yeah. So, but we will talk about some things to maybe to keep your mind off the various and sundry natural and unnatural disasters that we're faced with on a regular basis. And we'll talk about some transactions. And I don't know, per your idea, we're going to talk about some transactions that don't really have much to do with the players on the field as much as they do the guys who make the decisions. Our big move of the day is to talk about the extensions given to one front office and one field staff person in Pittsburgh. Neil Huntington and Clint Hurdle have both been extended by the Pirates, and this is interesting enough to spend some time talking about today, I think.
Yeah, it's an interesting decision, and I think it's one of those decisions where if you just look at it from the surface level, it makes a lot of sense. And then you dig deeper and maybe you kind of think yourself into pretzels about whether the Pirates should have done this or not. Let me just start by saying this. Neil Huntington has been the general manager in Pittsburgh since 2007. And that is crazy to me that he has been there that long. Think about how many general managers have been in place since 2007. There's maybe three. Brian Cashman, obviously. And I'm not even sure if I can name two more. I mean, that's just an insane tenure. And, the Pirates have obviously been pretty successful the last few seasons. I believe I saw a statistic that over the last 5 years, they rank like fourth in the majors in wins, which is impressive no matter your market. But it's doubly impressive when you're doing it from a small market with a small market payroll and the limitations that come with that. And yet there is some reason to have reservations about what Huntington has done, mostly as it pertains to drafting. They just have not really drafted well, which is sort of a must for a small market team. And you look at some of the, complementary moves that they made, and, maybe they haven't worked out quite as well as anticipated. So I guess I went from, that makes a lot of sense to maybe I've been overrating him because of the one loss record. Mm-hmm. What about you, Brian? Did you have any, not change of heart? Because I don't want to make it sound like I think Neil Huntington should have been fired. Again, I think he's probably at worst average to above average. But did you have any change in perspective when you dug in on these extensions?
Well, I'll just throw out real quickly, the only other regime that I can think of other than the Cashman regime off the top of my head who's been around for that long is probably Billy Beane with the Athletics, though he's not technically the general manager anymore. And Brian Sabian in San Francisco, he's still the decision maker.
Yeah, he's on the GM, though. Okay, and I pulled up on Wikipedia. Here are the reigns that are longer than Huntington's. And to be clear, he was hired September 25th of 2007. You've got Brian Cashman, who was February of 98. Mm-hmm. You've got John Daniels, who was October 2005. And you have Dayton Moore, who was June of 2006, And then Huntington ranks fourth. You know who's fifth? And this is surprising to me too. Take a
No,
guess.
off the top of my head, maybe Jeff Luno's been around for a little while now. I don't know.
He's down with us a little bit, but it's Mike Rizzo, and that was 2009.
Wow, really?
And then Alderson, and then Hoyer, Duquette, and then Luno. So
Okay.
good to
Well,
know.
that's pretty surprising. I'm surprised to hear that. I mean, yeah, the Bean and Sabian things, and maybe even Kenny Williams with the White Sox are kind of those guys who've moved up into higher roles. But it's, I don't know, a little bit of the same of organizational philosophy. But going back to your question about Huntington, there's a philosophy that you should kind of change up your front office or your general manager every few years because the institutional legacy that they leave behind will stay in place, and you would have the opportunity for more new ideas to come into an organization, to mix things up, to change things up, new personnel, new ideas, and that may be a net positive by itself. I don't know if I necessarily subscribe to that idea, but it is something that's kind of out there as a possibility why the Pirates might want to bring in somebody else to run front office operations. But I have a really tough time thinking about what the better move would have been rather than extending Huntington here. There aren't a whole lot of well-known free agent, let's say, front office executives who might be interested in the job. The Pirates are in kind of a tough position going forward. You mentioned the fourth in wins over the last several years. Honestly, I'm really surprised about that. I would not have expected that despite the Pirates' success, just because you don't really think of them as a top five team in wins over the last 5 years or whatever it's been. I'm more in the camp that the Pirates should definitely have kept Huntington. I think the way he seems to run a front office and bring on personnel around him seems to be something that, even if it's not necessarily reflecting in the results right now, from what I've read in like Big Data Baseball and from what I've read of folks following the team, it seems like he, for lack of a better term, runs a tight ship, and I think he brings the right people on staff. I think he definitely deserves a few more years to, I don't know, show some more value to the team before you'd move on to somebody else. But there is that little bit of me that thinks, well, would just another perspective be valuable to this team at this point? Have they gotten all they could out of a Huntington regime?
That makes sense. And I found this statistic. It's from Ben Badler, and his tweet was only four teams have won more games than the Pirates over the last 5 years. So I had the statistic a little wrong, but that's still impressive. And you're right, because it doesn't really feel like they're that high. And maybe that's just the bitterness of this season and last playing into that. Because to be fair, they won 94 games, 88 games, and 98 games from 2013 through 2015. I will say there's an
Wow.
aspect here that we haven't mentioned that goes beyond, asset management or, draft classes or whatever. And that's that the Pirates have at times been a bit of a public relations nightmare. And this kind of resurfaced with the Juan Nicasio stuff, where, they basically just gave Juan Nicasio away. And then, a week later, he gets traded to the Cardinals for a prospect who is now in the Phillies' top 30. And, I'm not saying that that prospect would have been worth taking on, but it's certainly not a great look for the Pirates, especially because, it seems like whatever Pittsburgh does, there's always going to be the financial aspect that gets focused on. And I don't think that's a distinctly Pittsburgh thing, but I do notice it a lot more with Pittsburgh than most any other small market team. I also note that, earlier in Huntington's regime, there was a lot of that kind of stuff. Matt
Right.
Capps, I don't know if you remember the Matt Capps non-tender, but Huntington basically came out and said because information was leaked that we were going to non-tender him, we were not able to trade him. And, I still don't know what to make of that. And then there was the whole boot camp thing they had with the prospects. And I mean, there's been, I think, one or two other things over the years. And, to their credit, it seems like they've gotten better at handling people and maybe even handling leaks and whatnot. But, that aspect still kind of pops up in my head now and again. I will say that I think it's going to be a very interesting offseason for them because it's a weird dynamic on that roster. You have some young players like Bell, and I know Gregory Polanco's not having a good season, but he's 25, you know, there's probably still reason to think he can become a productive ball player like last year. You know, even
Sure.
Adam Frazier is kind of interesting to me in a super sub way. Then, you know, you have a lot of young pitchers there. And because, you know, you look at this team on paper, it's like, you know, they're not that far away from being interesting. But, you know, Andrew McCutchen's contract is going to expire after next season, and it seems likely that they'll try to move him. And, you know, I guess I just question where the improvement's going to come from. You figure Starling Marte is going to be better than he has been this season because, you know, look at it one of two ways here. Either he was not doping throughout his earlier portions of his career and he was a productive player, or he was so good at doping that he was and he was getting away with it. You know,
Right.
whichever, if you want to be optimistic or cynical, it's still, you know, boding well for him returning to a productive player. But I don't know. I think this team is decent. I think they're in a position where if they really want to, they can compete next season. Maybe not for the division crown, maybe just for a wild card spot. But I wanted to transition to Clint Hurdle because we had not mentioned him at all. And I'll just say that I'm a fan of Clint Hurdle. I like his story. I like that he's a great quote. And I wanted to break out one of my favorite Clint Hurdle quotes just to, you know, make the point here. This is something that he said at the leadership prayer breakfast in Manatee County. And I'm going to just ask you, who do you think he's talking about here when he says she is one of the greatest leaders of all time?
Wow, I wouldn't have any idea.
He was talking about Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz. And
Really?
that just
That's funny.
delights me so much that he would be like, you know who's a great leader? Dorothy. And the way he puts it, like, it doesn't seem like he actually realizes that she is a fictional character. And frankly, why would you want your manager to acknowledge that, you know, Dorothy isn't a real character? But yeah, I like Hurdle. I don't know that he's the best in-game manager. However, you know, that's only a part of, you know, the job. And I don't know, man. I think he's probably average to above average. And I think the above average aspect comes from stuff that we aren't really good at managing and evaluating. And let me just transition back to the quote now. She took three people that were missing something and had them look back inside themselves to find something they thought they never had. She wanted to go home. That was mission number one. But in the end, it was all about everyone else. So that's, God bless you, Clint Hurdle, because that is an amazing quote. And I have not forgotten it, even though it's almost 3 years old.
That is a really cool quote. I am with you on supporting Hurdle. The thing for me is in reading Big Data Baseball, the really great look into kind of the transition that the Pirates made from, you know, laughing stock to, you know, well-adjusted, successful baseball team by Travis Sawchuk. I really got the impression that Hurdle has the willingness and the ability to adapt his line of thinking given new information in new situations. And to me, that's incredibly valuable, even if it's not something that's data-based or necessarily, you know, something that's measurable. Having a manager who is willing to be open to new perspectives, I think, is going to be absolutely critical. You've seen it with different teams and different people in the past where new information comes into baseball at such a rapid pace. And I'm not even just talking about data from front offices and changes in analytics, but new players coming onto the team and you know, people coming in from different organizations and being able to kind of change and adapt and do so in a thoughtful way, I think is a it's almost a rarity in baseball. You see guys like Terry Collins or Buck Showalter, and not to be critical of Showalter, but they have their own way of doing things and they're going to do it their way, and God help anybody who gets in their way kind of thing. And that may work for some teams, but I think that's really valuable, especially for a team like the Pirates, which they don't have a huge payroll. They have to be very creative and clever in some of their roster moves and some of their, you know, influence of analytics. They're always going to be bringing in, cycling in new players or younger players. So to me, I think Hurdle's kind of an ideal manager for their system, and I wouldn't want to see them replaced with somebody else who might be kind of a wild card.
I agree with that. Although I do love Buck Showalter, for the record. He is fantastic. I would say that Hurdle makes me think that experience is an underrated aspect for managers. And I don't just mean positive experience. I think failure is a very important thing for a manager to have experienced. Because his Colorado stint did not really go well. And I mean, in Big Data Baseball, it seemed like Hurdle was basically right on the edge of getting fired again before the Pirates turned it around. And I think that, you know, if you read that book, and if the book is an accurate portrayal of how events unfolded, and I have no reason to think it's not, but, you know, if that is accurate, then Hurdle basically said, you know what, my way is not working. I have failed, and this is my last chance. So I'm going to, you know, do the logical thing and kind of switch my style up and, you know, be more willing to take those chances and expand my worldview, which is something you just talked about the importance of. But I feel like if you're a first-time manager, you're not necessarily going to be open to that because you're not going to have failed. You're not going to see that, you know, your preconceived notions are not necessarily reality-based or not necessarily, you know, helpful for the position. So I actually think, you know, Hurdle in general is a great example of where taking on a retread, although it's not always a sexy move, can really pay off, even if it's not necessarily the trend you see in baseball now. And that's part of the reason why I loved the Nationals hiring Dusty Baker. I mean, he, for one thing, Baker had succeeded everywhere he went. And I know people like to credit Barry Bonds for a lot of that. But if you looked at if you looked at Dusty Baker's winning percentage as a manager and you took out the years he had Barry Bonds, it was still right there. His winning percentage, was still right there of Joe Maddon's career. And, you know, I mean, Baker has just won everywhere he's gone. And I thought that was a smart move. And I think experience in general might be underrated nowadays, not just for managers, but in front offices, on scouting staffs and whatnot. It seems like everyone wants to go younger or with a fresh perspective. And I understand that. But I think when everyone is doing that, who becomes undervalued by the market? It's the people who have experience, who, you know, are more in tune maybe with the old way of doing things. And I think, you know, hiring a Baker, hiring a Hurdle is a good way to not go counterculture necessarily, but to take advantage of the market and gain perspective and to gain skills that are perhaps undervalued by everyone else. Because you're picking from the best of the experience bunch, the best of the retread bin, as opposed to trying it. And I mean, you know, how many first-time managers have been hired in the last 5 years? You're not getting the top of the top anymore. You're getting, what, the 14th best, the 15th best of that group? So let me put it this way. When the Mets fire Terry Collins or when he retires, if they were to bring in Clint Hurdle, would you be happy with that?
Oh, absolutely. I would be very happy with Clint Hurdle as manager of my favorite team, no matter who they are. It's not necessarily a given that he's going to be the best possible manager that they could hire, but he has a track record of success now, and he has all the tools to, you know, prove that he's done a good job in the past. And you don't get that with a fresh out of, you know, playing career hire all the time. You know, people have talked about from the Mets guys like Robin Ventura, and Robin Ventura is another guy who has some managerial experience, but not the wealth that Hurdle has. So I would kind of be fine with that. But I definitely think experience in and of itself, and I mean, failing experience also is not necessarily a wonderful thing if it's not the right person. Like, for example, when Terry Collins came onto the Mets, he had plenty of experience failing. He was a terrible manager during the early part of his career. That didn't make him a good choice. I still do not believe he was a very good manager for most of his tenure with the Mets, not just this most recent run. You know, you can see the same thing when, you know, Art Howe went over to the Mets. Or I'm sure there are plenty of instances of different managers in other places where experience isn't the only good thing. So, but yes. I do think that Hurdle has the best combination of those things to be useful. And your comment about it being perhaps a market inefficiency at this point to get older managers with broader experience is I would think that's got to be true.
And I'm also going to say that I think getting, if you are going to go the rookie manager route, why aren't you reaching out to like a Molina brother or Ivan Rodriguez or someone who, in addition to kind of being overlooked by the market, has a skill that can obviously help you in being bilingual? You know, it seems like every single first-time manager being hired is just, frankly, an English speaker who may or may not speak Spanish, but that doesn't seem to be a priority. And it doesn't make sense to me because isn't the game becoming more and more diverse? And wouldn't having someone who can speak a fluent second language be very helpful from a manager position? And yet, how many teams actually seem to identify that as an attribute they want in their clubhouse and leading their staff? And I really just don't understand that because it seems to make a lot of sense to me. Why wouldn't you give, you know, Ivan Rodriguez a chance or a Molina brother or Eddie Perez or, you know, whomever you want to identify here? It's just insane to me that those guys never even seem to get interviews, whereas, you know, Kevin Cash and Mike Redman and all these other, you know, to be clear, I'm not calling Evan Rodriguez a mediocre former catcher, but it seems like mediocre former catchers usually get these jobs, and yet, you know, not if you speak Spanish, I guess. So that would be another inefficiency that I would look into. And frankly, it's also the right thing to do to give these guys opportunities, because, you know, why shouldn't they be getting these opportunities? But that's a rant for a different day. I would just say that I think experience, and I think, you know, thinking outside of the box, thinking outside of the catcher's box can be helpful here, because, you know, it just seems like everyone is hiring the same kind of manager. And when that happens, you should definitely zag, because everybody is digging to that same talent pool. So, you know, go get the best of a different pool. And it wouldn't surprise me if, you know, you end up getting the best bargain of the entire bunch. So,
yeah, I don't think there's any argument from any of us that diversity in hiring managers is something that's been a weird kind of topic of discussion the last couple of years, and how few Latin managers are getting the opportunity to manage in the big leagues. Though, you know, Ruben Amaro is out there, and he's working hard to get back into that kind of role, it seems.
That would be fascinating if he becomes like a successful field manager after his general manager run, wouldn't it be?
Yeah, it would be totally fascinating. But I think that gets to part of the problem with hiring Latin managers, is I think there's either some implicit or I'm not even saying there's an outright bias, but when your front office is primarily white, then it seems to stand to reason that your hiring of field staff might be primarily white as well. So it could come down to an issue where, you know, if there were more Latin Americans in the front office in baseball operations running player development, then you might have more of a chance of getting some of that field staff, the coaching and the managerial staff to be Latin as well.
And of course, there should be more Latins and minorities in the front offices. And you're right, you know, people want to hire people who remind them of themselves. And we used to be all about, you know, old baseball men, and now it's shifted to more of a new standard, you know, the new line of thinking and whatnot. But, you know, either way, exclusion has been one of their best skills. You know, unfortunately, you know, hopefully that changes, and it needs to change. But yeah, I really just don't understand how all these, you know, successful Latin players, you know, they get praised for their staff handling, they get praised for this and that, and then when it comes time to hire them after their playing careers are over, teams are more than willing to hire these guys as like coaching instructors or, you know, whatnot. But in terms of like giving them a real position, a power within the organization, they are not open to that. And, you know, it's really sad to me.
Yeah.
Why can't Benji Molina be a decent big league manager? And I'll accept that not every one of these guys is going to be, but how do you not give any of them the opportunity? Because I don't accept that every single former Latin backstop is unqualified to be a manager, and yet Kevin Cash and Redman and, you know, even
Mike Matheny. That,
exactly, Mike Matheny. And that's the ever funny thing here. Mike Matheny basically started this trend, right? Like, he was the first, you know, guy who basically walked off the playing field and became a manager. And
Brad Ausmus was
there. Okay. I'll give you, no, I think Matheny predates Ausmus though, right?
I don't think so, but I will,
we can check
it's probably very close.
The point is though, either one of those guys, the sabermetrics community thinks they're horrible managers.
Yeah.
So why is everyone, you know, this new school of general manager keeps chasing that model? Who has that model produced that's actually considered a good manager? You know what I mean? Because A.J. Hinch spent a few years in the front office, so I don't think you can necessarily say he is of this model, although, you know, his earlier gig, maybe you do say that. Kevin Cash, I don't know that anyone is necessarily a diehard fan of his, although to be fair, you know, some of that is the rosters he's had to deal with down there. I mean, who is like the poster child for this model working? Because I am struggling to think of a really good manager who walked off the field and is universally, you know, acclaimed for his managerial skills.
Well, I won't say walked right off the field, but the closest I can get is maybe Dave Roberts.
Fair. I thought you were going to say Andy Green, because he seems like a guy who could morph into a well-regarded manager just as soon as that Padres roster gets better.
I think Andrew Green should be pretty well regarded right now. I like him very much, actually.
We're both Andy Green fans here. So, yeah. Andy, if you're listening, we got your back, man.
And Craig Counsell spent, I think, a little bit of time working his way through. I don't think he counts as a straight off the field guy.
Yeah, I think
By the way, I did the research. You are absolutely right about Matheny over Ausmus. I, for some reason, just completely thought that Ausmus had been with the Tigers for longer than he had, which is a bad, bad sign
What
because
would you do if the Mets hired Brad Ausmus as their next manager?
I would be very disappointed.
Or get Ron Washington.
Ron Washington, I might be more okay with for sure. I
Bo
think.
Porter?
Oh, Bo Porter would be really interesting because of the way he's worked with young players before. So I'd be fine with Bo Porter. You know, really, just what I would like to see is the Mets bring somebody in who's very different. You know, to change things up quite a bit. So,
Is there a name you have in mind here? I mean, you
well, I.
seemingly hinted at it. I don't know. I know you don't want Robin Ventura necessarily, but.
Well, the guy who keeps getting mentioned is Bob Guerin, who I don't think is different enough, but I think would be a fine managerial position. But there's at least one guy in their minor league system. I think Ken Obergefell's time has passed, and Frank Viola is in line to be a pitching coach, but not so much. I'm blanking on the guy's name. I think he does either the single A or the double A team. He is a.
I will Google that, but I'm just glad you have not mentioned Mr. Wally Backman
Oh,
because
God, no. He's horrible. That guy's the worst. Might as well hire Lenny Dykstra. No, he's he, no, that
I
would be
mean, if
terrible.
Sandy Alderson DMs him, you don't know. I
Yeah,
mean,
it's
leave it
more
from
like Fred
there.
Wilpon. Alderson hates him, but yeah, if Fred Wilpon sent him a message, he would react with alacrity. He would be in there. Oh, that would be. I gotta clear the palate from that. We can't talk about this sort of
Paul
thing anymore.
LaDuca is also going to get mentioned. You realize that, right?
No, that's horrible.
Hey, he is
Yeah.
Joe McEwing. He's going to get mentioned. You already know.
Well,
Edgardo Alfonso, maybe, probably
now
not.
Alfonso has done some stuff in the minor leagues, I think, with the Mets, and I think he's all right. But I really, gosh, it's killing me that I can't get the.
Luis Rojas.
Yes, thank you. Luis Rojas. Yes, he has a really good reputation. They brought him up. I think he did some AFL managing, and I think they brought him up to the team in 2016, like around September or something, to be with the big club in the playoffs. And he seems to acquit himself well and has a really good reputation in the org. So he
Well,
might.
let's root for him.
Let's root for him, but I mean, let's be serious. There's no way they'll go
No.
with like Chip Hale or somebody else. They're very insular, so I'm sure they'll bring in somebody else who's got some experience. But I'd be shocked if it's not Bob
And I think that's a good place to leave that. So we're going
Guerin.
to transition to our batting practice segment, which is where perhaps Mr. Rojas will find himself throwing, or well, maybe if the Mets, filler staff from within. And our first move was actually a fairly interesting one because the Nationals brought one of the top outfield prospects in baseball up to the majors. That would be Victor Robles. So, what do you think of this call up, Ryan? Is it just, for show, or do you think he'll actually play a role in the rest of the season?
Well, I definitely think he'll play a role. There are skills that he has that make him completely viable as a September call-up and perhaps even on the 25-man roster in the playoffs because he's fast and he plays great defense. And there's a chance that he'll hit better than some of the other guys who are fast and play great defense that are already with the Nationals roster. You know, he could very well be an improvement over the Brian Goodwins and the Michael Taylors even today. Even though he's not fully actualized on his incredible hit tool yet
He's
in the
20.
major leagues. Yeah, that's just it. He's 20. So I think this call-up makes sense as long as maybe the team doesn't put quite too much pressure on him and as long as the team, you know, uses him in the proper way, which I think is going to be getting him a taste of some at-bats, not putting him out there against really dominant pitchers of the opposite hand. Don't focus too much on setting him up for failure, but yeah, I think Robles is one of the most talented minor leaguers in the game. He's a top five prospect for sure. The thing that I keep noticing is it seems like there's more desire to call up top prospects earlier, that players might be hitting their peaks a little bit earlier. So get him up in the majors, see what you got in him.
Yeah, I agree with that. And, we talked about Goodwin and Taylor. Both of those guys have actually been decent this season. Both
Yep.
have OPS plus over 100. I really think this is more about perhaps getting an upgrade over Andrew Stevenson and Alejandro Diaz and, some of those other players who have just been putrid. I mean, do you know what Diaz's OPS plus is in 52 plate appearances this season?
I mean, I can guess, having watched him over the last couple of
Hit
years,
me.
that the OPS plus is probably like, 75, something
Oh
really.
man, it's seven.
Seven. Oh no, that's.
Seven. Let me put it this way. Diaza has 7 hits and 46 at bats. Robles already has a hit in his first 4 at bats. So even if he just keeps that pace going, he's going to pass Diaz in like a week's time. So
Yeah, that's really ugly.
yeah, so they've really, I mean, they were playing Adam Wynn and Howie Kendrick in left field, and both of those guys have been productive, but I see no harm in bringing the kid up and giving him some exposure to the majors. And this is a team that, in all likelihood, is going to be, if not all in, pretty close to all in next year with Bryce Harper's pending free agency. He could play a part in that, and there's no harm in, giving him some exposure. Plus, the Nationals just clinched yesterday, so I mean, really, what is there to lose here? It's not like they're really playing for a whole lot at this point. They're not going to catch the Dodgers with regards to home field advantage. So, well, they probably won't catch the Dodgers with regards to home field
It's possible
advantage.
that the Dodgers will lose every game from now until the end of September, but pretty unlikely.
Yeah, I mean, the gap has gotten pretty small. It's 4 games now, which is not what we would have anticipated, as recently as a week ago.
No, not even
So
close.
we'll see. I don't think it's likely. It's hard to make up 4 games or what, 19 games or whatever. So who knows? We'll move to our next move now, and that would be an injury to another top young outfielder, Bradley Zimmer of the Indians. So I actually do not know what Bradley Zimmer's injury is at this point. I know he left the game with, oh, he broke his hand diving into first base. Oh, that's
Yeah,
not good.
it's
See,
the.
I knew he left the game last week with a head injury, and I actually missed this one because, Hurricane had my attention apparently. So
Yeah, it's the one of those injuries that make you crazy if you're an analyst type because you can't understand why ball players slide into first base, but at the same time it's one of those instincts that's very, very difficult to control after you've had these years and years of training. But I actually think this is maybe a bigger deal for the Indians than almost anything else that's come up. I mean, the Indians seem invincible, so I'm sure nothing seems like a big deal. But Zimmer's really come around as a pretty valuable and important part of this team, and I definitely think it's going to hurt them if he's not available to play right when they get started in the playoffs this year.
yeah, I mean, he's really been a pleasant surprise. I know he was a top prospect, but I'm not sure anyone, well, he's been a pleasant surprise in some ways. I know the offensive numbers aren't necessarily great, but he's really can go get it out in center field, and he adds some speed to this team. He's like 18 for 19 on stolen base attempts, which is pretty cool. And they have a number of guys who are, let's put it this way, good but not great at stealing bases. So they'll steal like 15 to 20 bases, but they're not going to be huge volume thieves, which that's fine. You don't necessarily need a Rajah Davis type to have that play up in the postseason. Hopefully he's back by the postseason, because you don't want to see any team get to this point, especially a team as good as Cleveland, and then suffer a couple injuries like they have, and have their playoff run basically sabotaged by luck. So
Yeah,
I
and
mean, we're talking about the Nationals. Like, I'm looking directly at the Nationals right now because that seems to describe them every single year.
I couldn't agree with you more. The thing that's kind of interesting about this is, Zimmer, his value right now to this team is the base running and the defense, and I don't know there's a good way to supplement that. But this does kind of get interesting because maybe this means Greg Allen will get some time in center field, and Allen's one of the, few other guys on this team who can run. But he is very, very raw. He just came up from double A. He's not like Victor Robles raw. He's even more raw than that. So it'd be really interesting to see if they give him some extra playing time with that, or if they wind up just sitting on Austin Jackson and Tyler Nakin. Yeah, like you said, the Indians have so many dudes and just none of them are very exciting. So who knows?
Yeah, and I think that's about all we have to say about that boring situation. So let's move on to the next move, and kind of talked about it earlier already, but Juan Nicasio's stay in Philadelphia was short. Just a week after being claimed off waivers from the Pirates, the Phillies shipped Nicasio to the Cardinals for a minor league infield prospect named Eliezer Alvarez, and Alvarez does find himself in the Phillies' top 30 list on MLB.com, so take that for whatever it is worth. And this season he has primarily played in double A, where he hit 247, 321, 382. So the numbers aren't necessarily going to pop off the page to you. However, for a week of Juan Nicasio in what amounts to 3 more weeks of him, that's, to get anything, let alone someone who can technically rank in your top 30, is a pretty good deal. So nice job by Matt Klintak there. That's a nifty little bit of, what do they call it? Arbitrage. Yeah. We're using the fancy words today,
Oh
folks.
yeah, we're analytically minded. I agree. This is a really kind of cool trade for the Phillies. They really took advantage of something. So here's my question: why do the Cardinals do this?
I mean, to be fair, they're just 2 games back in the division now.
And who's their closer now? It's Juan Nicasio. He's been closing for them since he came to this team. He's gotten the 2 saves.
And it's interesting because, I included, I think everyone thought the Cubs were going to run away with this. Even, a few days ago, I would have said, yeah, the Cubs have this on lock. You look at what's left of their schedule. 11 of their 19 games are against the Brewers or the Cardinals. And I believe the split is 7 of those are against the Cardinals. Look, anything can happen in 7 games or over 19 games. If the Cardinals just win those series, they have a chance of sneaking into the postseason here. And I know they traded Mike Leake, and we all kind of threw in the white towel and said, you know what, they're planning for next year and whatnot. I mean, there is a legitimate chance here that in 3 weeks the Cardinals have won the National League Central, which is hilarious to me. I mean, I know we're all supposed to hate the Cardinals, blah, 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 but it would be just so funny to me if somehow the Cardinals end up winning a division that looked like A, it was the Cubs to take, and B, that if anyone other than the Cubs were going to take it, it was going to be the upstart Brewers, who everyone could kind of rally behind as, the so-called good guys or, what have you. So part of me is, Team Anarchy here, which does not mean like a five-way tie or something. It just means the Cardinals win the division and then go on to win the pennant, because I think that would create the most chaos as opposed to, one of these huge tie scenarios.
Yeah, I mean, it's so strange right now. I really don't know what to make of this. We talked for at length about the Cardinals and, how their roster kind of looks like a mishmash at this point. We don't know, if they should be kind of playing for now or playing for the future, or what they're going to do going forward. And I mean, you look at their lineup right now, and regular work is going to Paul DeJong, who has turned into, again, that's definitely the devil magic at work there. Jose Martinez has slid in as the everyday first baseman now, which is, just bonkers to think about how they get these guys who just come up and start producing. You look at their bench, and now that the rosters have expanded, their bench still looks like crap. It's terrible. And, it's just one of these things where it's just so tough to imagine them having this kind of success. The other way this could go is, having all those games against the Cubs and the Brewers, they could also be out of it in a week
Yeah, absolutely.
if they run off a bad stretch of things. If they lose 2 out of 3 against Cincinnati, which is their next coming up series before they start in on that, then all of a sudden things look really dark, I think, for their chances. So I just this is one of those things where it's going to be fascinating to look at the end of the season and kind of track their trajectory over the entire 2017 season and just say, wow, what really happened here?
Right. Yeah, and while we're talking about the National League Central, probably a good time to mention our next move. And it's a bit of a bummer. Jimmy Nelson, who I think you can safely call the ace of the Milwaukee Brewers, is going to miss the rest of the season. He left his start over the weekend with what was described as a sore arm. Turns out he not only has a rotator cuff strain, he has a partially torn anterior labrum in his throwing shoulder. Not clear yet if he'll need surgery, at least based on the last report I saw. And of course, the thing is, he did not injure himself pitching. He injured himself diving back into first base because he took too wide of a lead on a single. So that's less than ideal in many regards, and it puts the Brewers in a, well, let's just say it again, less than ideal situation, because here they are with a chance to claim that unexpected playoff spot, and yet they're going to be without a guy who is almost certainly their best starting pitcher on the season. Is a 1.26 ERA plus, strikeout to walk ratio over 4. I mean, this has been his coming out year, and unfortunately, it's going to end on a sour note. So, Ryan, do you think the Brewers have any chance now without Nelson of still making the postseason?
Making the postseason, yes. Getting through that wild card play-in game, no chance. I
That
think
makes sense.
I mean, you know, there's always a chance, of course, but you tell me that they're the wild card. If they're the second wild card team playing against the Diamondbacks in Arizona and they're throwing, like, I don't know, Zach Davies or Matt Garza out there, no, I'm gonna put a 65% chance that the Diamondbacks win that game, maybe
That is
70.
very aggressive. Very aggressive.
I
That is
mean,
crazy. That's actually crazy to me because you know who leads the majors in wins, Brian? Zach Davies.
yeah, but
You
I'm not even going to get into it.
know who
You
Zach
know,
Davies
I
does to
know,
wind
our
him though?
listeners know. But Nelson has been like a legitimate ace this season. He is striking out 10 guys per nine. He is, DRA, FIP, ERA, they all are pointing to a 3 run per 9 pitcher. He, like you said, it's absolutely a coming out party. It's absolutely the one thing that the Brewers needed more than anything else was to develop an ace, like have a really top flight starting pitcher, and they did it. Congratulations. Now he's gone for the rest of the season, and it's a shoulder injury, which sucks because you never want this to build into something greater in the future, something more, the rotator cuff can be a real mess. So I'm going to hope for the best. I think that this does really do a number on their playoff chances, though.
I agree with that. I will say though that Zach Davies reminds me of Jeremy Hellickson, which is either a good thing or a bad thing, depending on which Jeremy Hellickson you've been exposed to. And we should mention Chase Anderson here, because he actually has the lowest ERA among Brewer starters, 2.93. His strikeout to walk ratio is near 3. And it would be kind of funny if he ends up getting a start against the Diamondbacks in a wild card game, considering, he was traded from the Diamondbacks to the
Right.
Brewers. So I would put his name over Matt Garza. I just can't imagine a scenario shy of them having to exhaust both Davies and Anderson in the final series of the year where they would actually go with Matt Garza in the wild card game. Although, strange things happen all the time, so we shall find out what happens in Milwaukee.
Matt Garza, the guy with playoff experience on this Milwaukee Brewers team, though.
Hey, he was a big game pitcher in 2008,
Yes, he
right?
was. Yes, he was.
Here's
And
the thing. Okay.
he was
Let
much
me,
better
I
than
don't mean to cut you off here, but
no.
so I did a study one time, and I'm not going to pretend it was like a great study, but I looked at how Garza performed with the variable being who he went up against. And I mean, like, in terms of like Roy Halladay, it always seemed like he had an amazing start versus Halladay. And then when he went up against, Brad Bergeron or whatever garbage the Orioles were throwing, he would stink. And sure enough, there was actually a correlation between his performance and whomever he was facing. And I thought that was just. I still don't know if it's legitimate or just, a coincidence or what have you, but that was just amazing to me. And that said so much about Matt Garza. I think I like the idea at least that, yeah, he gets pumped up for like the big games when he's going against the opposing, ace or whatever. And then if it's like a journeyman fifth starter, he's like, you know what? I can just dial in today. I don't have to really try. But maybe
So,
Matt Garza would rise to the occasion of facing a Zach Greinke and just go out there and, turn back the clock to 2008 when he was well regarded or somewhat well regarded. I
maybe the question though you have to ask is in Garza's head, say Greinke is blown for the wild card game, and they throw him up against, oh, I don't know, Robbie Ray. Does he think of Robbie Ray as a top flight starter, even though he, does he have that reputation, and then does he rise to that level, or does he pitch worse, because he's like, well, this is Robbie Ray. I don't know if this is the guy I should be afraid of, kind of thing.
That's a good question. I'm going to respond to my own hypothetical. What if the asteroid knocks us all out before we even get to the wild card game? Because that's what the people of Kansas City are probably wondering too, because, well, they have made a change of closer. Kelvin Herrera has been replaced by a combination of names that you really won't believe. And if Brian didn't make the document that had these names, I would ask him to guess which three Royals relievers are now apparently vying for saves. Instead, I will just read them to him. And here we go. That's Brandon Maurer, Mike Minor, and Scott Alexander. And Brian, be honest, did you know that Scott Alexander was a real pitcher before you made this document?
Nope. I did not, and I feel stupid about it because I pride myself on being able to name most of the roster on almost every team. But nope, I was out of the loop on Scott Alexander until this season. So shame on me. But also shame on the Royals.
Shame on the Royals for having a pitcher who used name. Yeah, I mean, this is surprising to me because Herrera is heading for free agency, and I don't think that I had realized how high that ERA had climbed for him. That's, just ignorance on my part, but Yeah, it's a. Oh, excuse me. He's not heading for free agency this year. He's heading for free agency after next season. I'm sorry. I got him for whatever reason. I looped him in with all the rest of their pending free agents. But it's kind of cool to see Mike Minor rise to, this level because, he was a solid starter for a few seasons, got hurt this year in 68 innings. He's striking out nearly four batters per walk. And yeah, that's pretty cool. Scott Alexander, I'm not overly familiar with him either, but he has had a pretty ERA, and I guess I can see why they would loop him in on that front. I'm just going to name a couple of our Royals relievers or name a few more names, and you tell me if they're real people or not. You game
Okay.
for that?
Yep.
Kevin McCarthy.
Kevin McCarthy, not real.
Andrés Machado.
Andrés Machado's a real person.
Okay. This is not a reliever, but this would be a potential name anyway. Jacob Junis.
No, not familiar with that one.
All these guys are real for the record.
Oh, great.
Kevin
Fabulous.
McCarthy has a 2.97 ERA in 36 innings and a 1.9 strikeout to walk ratio. He's striking out less than, excuse me, fewer than five batters per nine. So
Wow. That's why I blocked him out of my memory. I do want
yeah.
to kind of follow up on Mike Minor because, Maurer is like the exact type of pitcher you throw in there to be a closer when you don't have a closer. And Alexander doesn't have really the peripherals to back up being a back of the rotation left-handed, back of the bullpen, I should say, left-handed like setup guy. But Minor, you talk about him, he's been excellent.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, this guy looks like he could legitimately be a closer. He could legitimately be, a top flight setup guy coming off this. And I just kind of wonder what's his market going to be like this offseason? Is this going to be a guy that teams are willing to spend a considerable amount of money on to bring him on?
Well, I'm going to tell you what his market's going to be like because he actually has a mutual option worth 10 million. So he's not going to hit the free agent market, most likely. I feel like the Royals will bring him back, or at least exercise that option and then shop him, as opposed to letting him walk as a free agent. So,
If it's mutual, though, do you think he's okay with it?
well, doesn't the team option usually trump the player option, or am I
I thought
mistaken?
for mutual options, then you both parties have to agree.
That's interesting. I actually don't know. It seems like whenever there's a mutual option, it usually behooves both parties to go for it, or it behooves the player to the extent where the team kind of gets to dictate. So I'm actually interested in the legality of that. I don't know the answer off the top of my head because I can't really remember it ever coming into play.
Because if I understood that correctly, which I may not, but I was under the impression that the team obviously would like to have, well, I wouldn't say obviously, but I think the Royals would like to have him back on a 10 million for 1 year. But with Minor, given his injury history, if he thinks he could get 3 years and 15, which I think his performance this season shows he could get more than that. He could get 3 and 30 maybe on the open market, or 3 and 35 or something like that. Especially as a lefty, he's got to go out there and try to get that. And then all of a sudden, this is a left-handed reliever on a market that, I mean, really, I think you could see him getting paid quite a lot of money because there'd probably be 20 teams interested in his services.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be one of those situations where, he's not only a interesting, like, I don't want to say a relief prospect or a closer prospect because that kind of undermines what he's done this season, but you're kind of getting in before the getting is good, so to speak. He's not yet established himself as a viable ninth inning pitcher. And I still think to some extent that, teams still place an emphasis on the idea of a guy having proven himself in the ninth inning. I could be wrong there, but it feels like that still matters to teams, even if it's just, a mental thing. Like, the manager's a little bit more comfortable if the guy's actually proven he can do that. Pitch in the ninth inning and succeed. So I don't know. It's going to be interesting, but I will note that he has a buyout for 1.25 million, and that is absolutely not going to come into play
No.
whatsoever.
Gosh,
So
no.
yeah, he's going to get paid. He's going to be paid, eight figures or whatever on his next deal, whether it's a 1 year contract for 10 million with the Royals or elsewhere. I do think the team option trumps there, but we'll find out. I mean,
Yeah.
we're only a matter of weeks away from figuring out.
I certainly defer to your knowledge on the matter, but he and Felipe Rivero and Brad Hand are all very similar this year, and they've all been used a ton as far as like these kind of breakout lefties go. I was just seeing Minor's thrown 68 innings, which is not a small amount for a guy who really hasn't had a whole lot of run over the last 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, and that's an interesting trend in general because there are pitchers out there who I don't think most of us are really familiar with who, I mean, I don't want to say they've become firemen, but they have become, you know, multi-inning workhorses. And I'm just looking at the leaderboard now for, you know, who's made the most multi-inning relief appearances. And I mean, you want to guess who, I mean, you want to guess at, like, who's up there. Again, this is just multi-inning appearances according to Baseball Reference. I'm going to give you, I don't know, just try and get one of the top five.
One of the top five should be easy. Chris Stavinsky.
He is not in the top five.
Really? Oh, he man. I thought for
he
sure
was he was 13th.
Okay, then the only other one that I know off the top of my head, and this is because of my following of Jeff Paternostro, is I'm going to guess Yusmeiro Petit.
He is number one in baseball. He's tied for number one with Chris Rusin of the Rockies. Let me just name some of these other names, though. Dominic Leon, Chad Green, Dustin McGowan, Craig Stammen, Ross Stripling, Tyler Duffy, Michael Gibbons, Anthony Swarzak, and you know who's at number 11?
No.
Scott Alexander.
And it all comes full circle. Petit, I know, has been really good in those multiple inning stints. That's kind of been his calling card for the last few years. Most of those other names are pretty bizarre, but I am going to stand up and cheer for Craig Stammen. I am so pumped about his resurgence this year and for completely, like, entirely petty and stupid reasons. I picked him to be the Vogelsong Award winner for the pitcher this year. So he did not get a comment in the Baseball Prospectus Annual 2017, and I chose that he would be the best player who is a pitcher not to get a comment in the annual, and I might be right.
You might be right. I will note one more pitcher who I thought was in the top 10, who I actually had in mind the entire time. Alas, my plans are foiled. That's Emilio Pagan of the Mariners. I just want to read his statistics. In 27 appearances, he's thrown 43 innings. He has struck out one batter per inning. He has walked 1.5 batters per nine. He has a 6.29 strikeout to walk ratio, a 1.38 ERA plus, a 2.87 FIP. He's done this while pitching multiple innings. I mean, that's a very impressive resume for someone who, to be frank, I don't think was on anyone's radar. And yet, you know, he's kind of been an unsung hero in that bullpen, even if he was going to remain unsung for the most part. Plus, he's from Simpsonsville, South Carolina, and you just know his annual comment is going to be some monstrosity that makes Woj just roll over in his grave, you know?
I'm sure you're right. 21% ground ball rate. Oh, my goodness.
Living dangerously.
That is so dangerous. Even in Safeco, that is... Oh, that is horrible.
Hey, he's a pagan, so he likes pointing at... Oh, he doesn't like pointing at the sky. You know what? I ruined that. Yeah. Well, it's he likes worst. Pointing at the ground because, you know, that's his god of choice. So on that note, we should probably wrap this up because it's descending quicker than Emilio Pagan fly ball. And I am RJ Anderson. You can find me at CBS Sports if for whatever reason you still want to find me. He is Brian Grosnick. You can find him at Baseball Prospectus, and you can find Sean Brody. Well, if you can find Sean Brody, please return him. We miss him. Thank you for listening, and have a nice day.